So imagine you're running like the most powerful, cutting-edge tech company in human history.
Okay, pretty good gig.
Right. And you're sitting on a private valuation of around $80 billion. But then you suddenly decide to give away 5% of your equity to a government fund.
Which is a massive amount of money.
Massive. But here is the catch. That government fund, it doesn't actually exist.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like a clerical error, right? Or maybe just some weird thought experiment. But it is a very real proposal currently sitting on the table from OpenAI's leadership. And, it forces us to look past the usual product announcements and really look at the actual architecture of the tech industry.
So things are changing fast.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We are watching the global power structure completely fracture and rebuild itself.
Welcome to today's deep dive.
Right.
We know you want the actual signal without all the noise, so we have taken a massive stack of tech research, market reports, and news from today, Friday, July 3rd, 2026, and synthesized what you actually need to know.
Yeah, we're exploring the underlying mechanics of how the future is being built, regulated, and of course, monetized.
Right. And the best place to start seeing this massive power shift isn't in some corporate boardroom. It's right at the software developer level.
The foundational layer. I mean, for the last few years, tools like GitHub Copilot and Cursor have been the unquestioned industry standards for AI-assisted coding, right?
Everybody uses them.
And they're mostly powered by foundational models from American companies like OpenAI and Anthropic. So the US essentially held a monopoly on this frontier-level generative AI.
Which is exactly why this launch of Z-Code is such a massive disruption. So ZAI, which is a Chinese company, they used to be known as Zipu AI. They just released this new AI-powered coding tool,
Right.
and it runs on their proprietary GLM 5.2 language model.
Right.
And the kicker here is the price. They are pricing the paid tier at exactly $16.20 a month.
Which is highly specific.
Right. It's a very deliberate undercut of the standard $20 a month subscription that Cursor and Copilot charge.
They are targeting the developer's wallet directly.
But wait, if I'm like a senior developer making six figures, I really don't care about saving $3.80 a month.
Sure.
I mean, if a cheaper AI model hallucinates some bad function and it costs me 3 hours of debugging time on a Friday afternoon, that $3 in savings is instantly wiped out. So why would anyone risk switching just to save the price of a cup of coffee?
Because the price is just the Trojan horse.
Okay, what do you mean?
Well, the actual disruption here is the underlying capability of GLM 5.2. We have to look at the mechanics of how ZAI even built this thing. The US government placed those strict export bans on high-end NVIDIA GPUs, right?
Yeah, to prevent Chinese companies from training these massive frontier models.
Exactly. So Z.AI bypassed that hardware bottleneck by optimizing their algorithmic efficiency. They likely utilized something called a sparse mixture of experts or MoE architecture, which let them train a world-class model on domestic hardware clusters.
Oh, wow. So they basically compensated for a lack of raw compute power with just highly efficient software design.
Yeah, and by doing so, they prove they can actually match the logic and context window capabilities of the American giants. So when Z-Code enters the market at 1620, it's not just a budget option. It is proof that the US monopoly on top-tier AI is over.
That's a huge shift.
It really is. When developers suddenly have four major, highly capable AI coding tools to choose from instead of just two, it forces price compression. It forces aggressive innovation across the entire industry. I mean, the era of American companies coasting on an unquestioned technical advantage is, it's ending.
Okay, let's unpack this a bit more.
Right.
Because while individual developers are suddenly getting these cheap, highly competitive tools, on the enterprise side, massive corporations are spending absolute fortunes on AI infrastructure.
Oh, yeah, billions.
Right. And a lot of them have absolutely no idea what to do with it once they buy it.
It's the industry's worst-kept secret, honestly. The gap between purchasing a massive enterprise AI license and actually deploying it effectively is huge. Fortune 500 companies are sitting on thousands of unused seats.
Just paying for them every month.
Yep, because their internal data is too siloed, or honestly, their employees just don't know how to prompt the systems.
It's totally like a corporate wellness initiative where the company buys everyone this ultra expensive top-tier gym membership.
That's the AI license.
Exactly. But a year later, nobody's getting fit because nobody knows how to use the equipment, their form is terrible, or they're just intimidated by the wait room.
That is a perfect analogy, and Microsoft recognized this exact bottleneck, which is why they just announced the launch of Microsoft Frontier Company.
Right, the new initiative.
Yeah, this is a $2.5 billion investment, assembling a team of 6,000 specialists, and their singular mandate is to help large organizations implement, design, and optimize these AI systems.
So they are basically the insanely expensive personal trainer hired to walk the client through the gym, adjust their form, and make sure they actually get a return on their investment.
Precisely.
But I mean, spending $2.5 billion just to teach people how to use software they already bought.
Yeah.
That seems a little steep, doesn't it?
It seems steep, but it reveals a fundamental pivot in business strategy. Microsoft realizes that the software alone is no longer the product.
Right.
If a client fails to integrate AI into their workflow, eventually, some CFO is going to look at the balance sheet and cancel that multi-million dollar Azure subscription.
Because they aren't using it.
Exactly. Microsoft has to sell success, not just access.
Yeah.
By launching Frontier, they are stepping directly into the territory of elite consulting giants, you know, like McKinsey or Accenture.
So they don't just want to host your data. They want to completely re-architect how your company functions.
Think about the lock-in effect here. If Microsoft Frontier comes into a global bank, cleans up decades of messy, siloed data, builds custom retrieval augmented generation pipelines for their analysts, and handles all the security compliance,
that bank is never leaving.
Never. They can't. Microsoft ties their proprietary technology directly to this white glove implementation service. It creates an almost unbreakable competitive moat.
And it generates staggering amounts of revenue, which actually brings us back to that massive paradox we mentioned at the very start of the deep dive.
The OpenAI proposal.
Yeah. All of this enterprise lock-in and frontier-level development is generating unprecedented wealth. And Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI, has proposed donating 5% of the company's equity to a U.S. sovereign wealth fund to benefit American citizens.
And just to put a number on that, the valuation estimates put that 5% at roughly $4 billion.
But like we said, the United States doesn't even have a sovereign wealth fund. Norway has one funded by oil. Some Middle Eastern nations have them. But writing a $4 billion check to a U.S. bank that hasn't even been built yet? I mean, what is the actual strategic play here?
Well, this proposal really forces us to look at two deeply contrasting perspectives on how AI wealth should be handled moving forward. Let's look at the first perspective, genuine wealth distribution.
Okay.
Altman has consistently voiced concerns that artificial intelligence will create a hyper-concentration of wealth in the hands of a few tech elites. From this angle, pushing for a sovereign wealth fund is a proactive attempt to ensure that the massive financial upside of universal basic compute actually yields a dividend for the wider public.
Kind of setting a precedent that the architecture of the future shouldn't just enrich Silicon Valley.
Exactly.
But the critics are looking at this through a much more cynical lens, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. They are viewing it as a highly calculated regulatory shield.
Because tech giants are under immense scrutiny right now from monopolistic behavior.
Yes. So think about it. If OpenAI gives the U.S. government, and by extension, the American public, a direct multi-billion dollar stake in its financial success, it creates a powerful misalignment of incentives for regulators.
Oh, wow. Because if the government relies on OpenAI's stock to pay dividends to citizens, the government is never going to break OpenAI up in an antitrust lawsuit.
That is the core of the criticism. It's viewed as preemptively buying goodwill and shaping future regulation by literally making the government a shareholder.
That is wild.
But regardless of which perspective you lean toward, the sheer fact that this proposal even exists forces lawmakers to grapple with the reality of tech dividends. We are having to actively invent new economic structures just to handle the wealth being generated here.
Yeah, and while OpenAI is offering up voluntary equity to maybe shape the regulatory environment, governments overseas are taking a much more aggressive approach to tech monopolies.
They definitely aren't waiting around for donations.
No, they are not. The European Union Court of Justice just rejected Google's final appeal against an antitrust fine from 2018.
8 years later.
8 years later. And the ruling is final. Google has to pay 4.1 billion euros, which is roughly 4.7 billion U.S. dollars.
And this was because the European Commission punished them for using the dominance of the Android mobile operating system to force device manufacturers to pre-install Chrome and Google Search.
Right, while actively blocking custom competing versions of Android from being developed.
Yeah.
But here's my issue with this. Google pulls in over $280 billion a year in revenue, a $4.7 billion fine, especially after they dried it out in appeals for nearly a decade while making hundreds of billions of dollars. I mean, that doesn't sound like a deterrent.
No.
It sounds like a parking ticket. It's just the cost of doing business in Europe at this point.
You're not wrong about the math, but the cash penalty itself isn't the existential threat to Google here.
It's not.
No. The threat is the finalized legal precedent it sets regarding distribution channels. The EU isn't trying to bankrupt Google. They are trying to commoditize their distribution.
Okay, how does that actually break Google's model, though?
So think about the ad revenue flywheel. Google's core business relies on vast amounts of user data exhaust to serve hyper-targeted ads. Android is the funnel that captures that data.
Right, because billions of people use it every day.
Exactly. By forcing manufacturers to set Google Search and Chrome as the unchangeable defaults, they guaranteed the funnel stayed full. But this EU ruling legally mandates unbundling.
Meaning they can't force the default apps anymore.
Right. If a user buys a new smartphone and the default search engine is suddenly DuckDuckGo or, you know, some localized European competitor, Google loses that specific stream of data exhaust.
So the flywheel starts to slow down.
And this finalized precedent acts as an accelerant for similar antitrust cases worldwide. Meta, Apple, Amazon, they are all watching this closely because it signals that governments are successfully mapping out how to dismantle the closed ecosystems these companies rely on.
It forces a fundamental change in how tech giants are allowed to acquire and trap users.
Absolutely.
But, you know, waiting 8 years for a court to finalize a fine is the slow way to break up a monopoly.
Yeah, the legal system isn't known for its speed.
If you really want to challenge a dominant megacorporation, the most effective method is when another megacorporation simply decides they want that market share, which is exactly what is happening right now in low Earth orbit.
The commercial satellite internet race.
Yes. Amazon just announced they have 396 satellites deployed for Project Kuiper, and they are officially launching commercial service by mid-2026.
They are taking on Elon Musk's Starlink directly.
And Starlink already has millions of subscribers and over 11,000 satellites in orbit. So it's a massive first-mover advantage. It's a classic David versus Goliath scenario, except David is Amazon. And he's bringing unparalleled financial power and the massive infrastructure of AWS in his slingshot.
It's a great way to frame it. And Amazon really needs that slingshot because they face a severe infrastructural bottleneck that SpaceX simply does not.
The rockets.
Exactly. SpaceX owns Starlink, but more importantly, SpaceX owns the Falcon 9 rockets. They control their entire supply chain to space, meaning they are launching at cost.
Right. Well, Amazon has to pay retail.
Yeah. Amazon has to rely on and pay premium rates to external companies like United Launch Alliance and Blue Origin just to get Kuiper satellites into orbit. The capital expenditure to scale this is astronomical.
But Amazon has a weapon that Starlink doesn't have. They have Amazon Web Services, AWS.
Which completely changes the battlefield. We tend to think of satellite internet as a consumer product, you know, getting Wi-Fi to a rural cabin or an RV.
Right, streaming Netflix in the woods.
Yeah, but Amazon's actual target here is enterprise cloud computing. By integrating Project Kuiper directly with AWS, Amazon is building a highly lucrative closed-loop ecosystem.
So how does that actually work for a business? What does that look like?
Imagine a massive global logistics company or a military contractor operating in remote areas. Right now, sending their data back to a central server involves bouncing it across various public or third-party networks, which introduces latency and, obviously, security risks.
Because it's touching the public internet.
Right. But with this integration, that enterprise can beam their proprietary data straight from a remote site up to a Kuiper satellite, and Kuiper beams it directly down into an AWS data center.
Oh, wow. So the data never even touches the public internet at all?
Never. It is the ultimate offer of security, speed, and latency control. Amazon doesn't need to win the consumer market if they can just bundle global secure satellite connectivity into the massive contracts they already hold with AWS enterprise clients.
They're using their dominance in cloud computing to subsidize and guarantee the success of their space infrastructure.
Exactly. The sky is no longer a monopoly.
Man, it's fascinating how these battles for infrastructure, whether it's AI models, satellite arrays, or antitrust lawsuits, they are playing out over years and decades.
Yeah.
But if you want to see the balance of power and wealth change hands in a matter of minutes, you only need to look at the cryptocurrency market.
Oh, yeah. The volatility this week has been insane.
Bitcoin just surged from a 21-month low of around $57,700 to over $62,500. It jumped 8% in less than 48 hours.
Dragging the rest of the market up with it. Ethereum, Solana, XRP, over $100 billion, was added to the total crypto market cap practically overnight.
And the report specifically notes that this sudden spike wiped out over $500 million in short positions. It triggered a massive short squeeze.
$500 million, just gone.
Right. I mean, betting against Bitcoin always seems like walking into a casino, betting against the house, and suddenly finding out you owe your entire life savings in 5 minutes. Let's break down the actual mechanics for everyone. Like, what happens during a squeeze like this?
So when traders short an asset, they are borrowing it and selling it at the current price, betting the price will drop. The goal is to buy it back cheaper, return the borrowed asset, and pocket the difference.
Standard short selling.
Right. But if the market shifts, say, long-term investors see 57 grand as a massive discount and start heavily buying, the price starts going up.
And the short sellers start bleeding money.
Rapidly. And here is where the mechanics get incredibly violent. If a trader's account collateral drops too low to cover their mounting losses, the exchange doesn't call them and ask what they want to do.
There's no customer service rep checking in.
No. The algorithm just steps in and liquidates them automatically. It forces a market buy of Bitcoin at whatever the current price is to close the short position and stop the bleeding.
So you have regular investors buying the dip, combined with an automated avalanche of short sellers being forced to buy at the exact same time.
Yes, it creates a ruthless feedback loop. That forced buying drives the price even higher, which liquidates more short sellers at higher price points, forcing even more algorithmic buying.
So over $500 million that was betting against Bitcoin was instantly vaporized and converted into upward price momentum.
Exactly. Which proves the latent demand in the crypto market is still incredibly strong.
It really is.
It is. But this exact mechanic, the reality that $500 million can be violently liquidated in 48 hours through algorithmic feedback loops, is what keeps conservative institutional money awake at night.
Oh, I bet.
It is a stark reminder that while the underlying technology of decentralized finance is maturing, the trading mechanics are still defined by extreme localized volatility.
Yeah, it really puts everything into perspective. We've traced a massive web of shifting power today.
We covered a lot of ground.
We really did. We started with China's Z.AI utilizing software efficiency to break the American monopoly on frontier AI.
Uh-huh.
We watched Microsoft pivot into an elite consulting firm to ensure their enterprise AI actually creates lock-in.
Yep.
We examine the paradox of OpenAI proposing an unbuilt sovereign wealth fund, wrestling with whether it's genuine wealth distribution or just a clever regulatory shield. We looked at the EU using antitrust fines not just to punish, but to actively commoditize Google's distribution flywheel.
Which is going to have massive ripple effects.
Huge. Then we saw Amazon leveraging AWS to build a closed-loop internet in space to fight Starlink. And finally, the sheer violent velocity of a 48-hour crypto short squeeze.
The foundational layers of the tech industry are completely realigning right in front of us. And it leaves you with a critical question to consider as you watch this all play out.
What's that?
Well, as artificial intelligence becomes as foundational as electricity, and as these mega corporations build the physical infrastructure in space and on the ground, while governments scramble to write the laws and capture the wealth, who actually ends up holding the keys to the future? Is it the companies building the technology, the regulators forcing the unbundling, or you, the user, choosing which closed-loop ecosystem to trust?
Wow. That is the exact question you have to ask yourself every time you see a headline. Ultimately, where you direct your attention and your capital decides which of these systems becomes the permanent infrastructure of our lives.
Couldn't have said it better.
Thank you so much for joining us for this deep dive. We know your time is highly valuable, and we love getting to sift through the noise to bring you the mechanics behind the stories that actually matter. Stay curious, keep looking at how the pieces connect, and we will catch you on the next one.